Defense spending patterns all over the world are changing. They're driven by each nation's economy, its politics, and sense of what the threats are. Conflict and unrest seem to spring up everywhere. It's a complicated mix, no less so for the United States, still the biggest defense spender. Our next guest advises defense ministries around the world on three points: how to adapt, collaborate, and invest. Jack Midgley is a director at Deloitte Consulting and principal author of Global Defense Outlook 2014, and he joins us now. Jack, good morning.
Good morning, Tom. Great to talk with you.
All right, so give us the overview of how different countries, the ones that matter, the big spenders, have responded differently to similar economic times that have affected everyone.
It's an interesting picture that's starting to emerge. We looked at the 50 countries worldwide that account for about 92% of the total defense spending around the world. And what we found is that it makes good sense to segment those countries, to look at them in terms of their economic growth rates and their overall commitment to defense spending. We found that the lower income countries are where the focus of most defense spending growth is, and the higher income countries, the Eurozone and others, are where defense ministries are cutting back. We put that down to a couple of things. One is the fact that in the lower income countries, economic growth and low debt is providing these countries with the opportunity to invest. And they also see defense spending as a way to build their economies, both by creating jobs and income internally and by creating new markets for export, new products for export. So we think that's a pattern that's going to persist. The higher income countries will continue to stay flat on defense spending, and we're going to see acceleration and convergence on the lower income countries.
And in terms of what they spend on, what trends do you see emerging?
Well, the high-income countries and low-income countries are very different in terms of what they spend on. The higher-income countries are very capital-intensive, so they spend a lot of money to support one active component serviceman. For example, in the five countries that we call the highest-income spenders, those are countries that have GDP above $30,000 per capita and that spend more than 3% of their national income on defense. Those countries, which include the U.S., spend about $400,000 a year to maintain one active service member. Now, they're not paying an active service member $400,000 a year. That's all the support spending and the capital that goes behind them. The lowest income countries, on the other hand, don't use a great deal of sophisticated technology. They don't spend on R&D. And so to maintain one active service member in the lowest income countries costs only about $50,000 a year. It's an eight-fold difference between the lowest income countries and the highest income countries. And that difference shows the different approaches to capital. We spend a lot on technology development, innovation, the very finest technology. The lowest income countries simply catch up. They buy lower tech, and their cost per soldier is much lower.
So I guess there's two interpretations of that. You tell me if I'm right here. The next five after the United States that have similar patterns, including Russia, are more like us, whereas those other countries, maybe the asymmetric differences are getting even more pronounced.
Well, we counted China in the lowest, in the lower income economizers. You know, we hear a lot about the Chinese military buildup, and in absolute terms, the number's gotten bigger. But the Chinese still spend a relatively modest share of their GDP on defense, and their cost per soldier is still quite low. The Russians, on the other hand, are moving in the direction of more capital spending. They have to. The Red Army collapsed, and since the end of the Soviet Union, Russian capital spending on defense has just tailed off very sharply. So now Putin is moving back in the direction of reinvesting, and we're seeing a lot of spending on capital equipment in Russia and the former Soviet republics.
So when you look at this disparity in spending, particularly when you're talking about service members versus R&D, what sort of clues does this hold for a smart Defense Department policymaker in terms of working with their partners?
Well, just before we started, your writer said maybe these are the good old days, and I think that might also apply in defense.
That must have been Mike Causey.
Mike was.
He'd say something like that.
A little pessimistic this morning, but I think seriously, in terms of where we're going in the United States, we've relied for decades on superior technology, and we do today. Not just nuclear, but stealth, UAV, precision strike, so forth. Over the next decades, we can expect, if the current trends continue, that that technology edge is going to decline relative to the rest of the world. That's not because we aren't smart or we aren't clever or we don't spend a lot of money. It's because it's easier and faster to catch up than it is to push the edge of the technology frontier. You're seeing that in particular, a particularly sharp relief with China. We're looking at now the development of a Chinese aircraft carrier, the development of Chinese stealth capability, sophisticated cyber capabilities. These look very high tech. What we're seeing is convergence. As the Chinese economy develops, their ability to manage, to build, to acquire very high technology weapon systems begins to approach the Western countries. We're going to see more of that. It's harder to push the technology frontier than it is to catch up. And so China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, the big defense spenders are going to have access to the kind of technology that we currently think of as U.S. only. And I think defense planners are going to have to begin to think about a world where our absolute edge in technology has diminished.
We're speaking with Jack Midgley. He's director of Deloitte Consulting and the author of the Global Defense Outlook 2014. Just as an aside, China might find it more convenient simply to take the intellectual property by cyber means as a shortcut to getting that parity. Does that seem to be what's happening?
Well, we've found some very interesting results when we looked at cyber. And we struggled a little bit because good data on cyber attacks and cyber activity is very hard to get. We turned entirely to publicly reported incidents of cyber attacks, and we counted them in 2013. When we did that, what we found was that about half of the reported cyber attacks in the world in 2013 were actually against lower-income countries, and even the smallest countries outside the top 50. The news we took away from that was that cyber is not just a China-U.S. matter anymore. Developing country status doesn't protect you against cyber attacks. Cyber attacks are happening across the development spectrum in countries that are rich, in countries that are poor. It's happening everywhere. That said, we also were able to detect a difference in the targets that are seem to be attracting cyber attack. In the rich countries, about two-thirds of the reported cyber attacks were directed against industry. In the lower-income countries, two-thirds of the cyber attacks are directed against government targets. Now, we're working with public data, which is going to tend to underreport attacks against government institutions in developed countries. So there's some softness in the data. But the size of the effect was really striking. It's two-thirds against industry in the developed countries, two-thirds against government in the lower-income countries. That suggests to us that governments are going to want to think differently about where they allocate their cyber assets depending on whether they are rich countries or poor countries. And in the U.S., if these reports actually reflect the underlying pattern, what we really have is threats to commercial businesses, to private enterprise, and less serious threats against the government, less frequent threats against government.
Can you talk a little bit about the flip side of that, the cyber operations? I mean, we know that the U.S. is ramping up. We can't get enough cybersecurity workers. What's happening worldwide?
This is becoming a preoccupation for governments around the world. For example, The Chinese cyber unit, PLA 61398, has attracted a lot of public attention because of the Mandiant reports and the very high visibility. But other countries are also moving in this direction. For example, the Russians have decided to set up a dedicated cybersecurity command, a new military service responsible for protecting just exclusively military information systems. They believe, they've said publicly, they believe that cyberspace will be a theater of war in future military confrontations. And as recently as the events in Crimea, public reports included a mention of Russian hacktivists, a group in particular called the Russian Cyber Command, which is not a Russian government entity. It's a group of hacktivists that attacked one of the state corporations and released a huge number of public documents. What they said they were doing was starting a true domestic cyber war against Russian military enterprises. So the Russians are dealing with it. India has announced a program to train 500,000, they use the word cyber warriors, by 2017, and they have begun a program of cybersecurity audits throughout the government. So across the world and across the income spectrum, governments are paying a lot of attention to the military potential of cyber operations.
I guess the whole world is becoming one big Bletchley Park. And a final question, when you look at what the Americans, what the United States are doing now with spending, do you get the sense that there's really an overarching strategy militarily and in terms of national security to what's going on with our defense budget, or is it simply cutting?
Well, the cutting is what gets public attention. But I think if you peel that back, there are some really difficult first-order questions being asked in all the services about what does it mean to confront a world where large land armies may not play the role that they've played in the past, where nuclear operations seem to be less relevant and less an instrument of foreign policy every year. What's the future of the United States Navy in this new world where cyber operations and power projection change in fundamental ways? We're at a point now that is unlike anything we've seen, certainly since the end of the Cold War and maybe since the end of the Second World War, in terms of the basic strategy and organizational approaches of our military services. And that's going to those debates are going to continue for the next several years, no matter what happens to the budget. We have to think about what's the future of our military services, what do they look like 10, 15, 20 years from now, and the questions and the opportunities are endless and fascinating.
Jack Midgley is a director at Deloitte Consulting and author of The Global Defense Outlook. Jack, thanks so much.
You're welcome.